Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, September 16th, welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today is one of those shows where some of you out there will hear the topic and you'll say, this has nothing to do with me. But I want you to stick with it because I think there is something universal in this show today. So the topic is AI in higher education, specifically in the classroom. There is a movement now for professors to teach in ways or to administer exams in ways that make it so students cannot access AI and generative AI, for instance, ChatGPT, Claude, etc. This is to prevent cheating. It is to make sure that they're not exporting learning to a machine. But I think the larger question it brings up, Cherry, that I was contemplating as I prepare for this show is really this whole conversation around AI focuses us on this idea of what is learning.
Yeah, yeah.
So is learning reproducing knowledge for an exam? Is it something deeper than that? Can you export certain parts of learning to a machine and still develop the skills that you need to succeed in the 21st century and beyond? So I've been thinking about that a lot as I prepare for this show. I'm very excited to have our guest on, who thinks about this stuff all the time for NYU. And we're asking you the following questions this hour. How do you think AI is changing higher education? What pros or cons do you see? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2 at whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Close the ChatGPT window and drop a comment in our chat.
Yeah, quick comment here. I began teaching at Temple University in 2021 and could literally see the difference in the students once ChatGPT became widely available.
All of a sudden, and they could write.
Oh my goodness, their writing went from you need work to oh my goodness, it's so perfect.
Better than me, yeah.
But when you called on them, they couldn't really do the critical thinking. And so you want to make sure that they're getting the bang for their buck for all the money people are spending for higher education. So many questions, technology's here to stay, but how do you make sure they're getting it?
But what thinking is critical these days?
I know, that's
the
question.
Because a lot of things that we used to define as critical thinking, you can now ask a machine to do for you.
But the thing is, people are going to be hiring these young people
exactly
to work for them, and you want to make sure that they can think through problems without the machine. And that's
they're thinking, I'll just keep asking ChatGPT.
I know ChatGPT will be here. So I look forward to hearing comments. How do you think AI is changing higher ed? What pros or cons do you see? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
Trio of local news stories. Cherry, start us off.
Okay. The Phillies just clinched their second consecutive NL East championship Monday night. Yay. The big win came when they beat down the LA Dodgers 6-5 in 10 innings. And if you're watching on YouTube, you got a little bit of flash of some shirtless folks cheering.
The Phillies,
by the way,
in the clubhouse after the game. It's not random shirtless people.
Sorry, yes, Phillies cheering. And if you watch the game, it was played on West Coast time. Very dramatic, a lot of back and forth. And this would mark their seventh win, the Phillies' seventh win in 8 days. And the Phillies are the first team to clinch their division championship. For a non-sports fan like me to be talking about this, you know it's a pretty big deal, right? And it is because it's the second year in a row that the Phillies clinched the NL East title and the fourth consecutive season that they are in the playoffs. And this is very reminiscent of the Phillies that existed when I moved to the city of Philadelphia back in 2008. They were in the middle of a multi-year run. They won the World Series in 2008,
yeah,
which was, I remember, smashed pumpkins on my porch when I came back. I know, because of the celebrations, because of the Phillies, they were celebrating.
It was your pumpkin and someone came up and
smashed it. Yeah, during the celebrations. I know.
Things get wild.
It got wild. So could they do it again? Who knows? A lot has happened during the season for them to get here. And I'll just say, go Phils.
Go Phils. Speaking of shirtless, I think when they won in 08, I think I did take my shirt off.
You took it? Oh, my goodness.
But, like, not in public, but okay. I was just, like, I was so overwhelmed with emotion, I didn't know what to do.
Did you rip it off? Like,
rah. No, okay. It wasn't Hulk style. I just it off. That's my memory, at least. So I will just say real quick, for folks who haven't been paying attention, you got to lock in on the postseason. It's coming up. Cherry mentioned that the Phillies have been on this run now for a few years. And I think what's interesting or notable about this upcoming playoff run is that we're closer to the end of this thing than the beginning at this point. This team has been together for a while. A lot of the key players are above 30, which in athletics terms means they're almost ancient.
Oh.
And so this could be maybe next year, maybe this year, but we might not have a lot more with this group. So enjoy it. It's a lot of the same faces that you're familiar with. And, you know, hopefully this is the time they get it done and go all the way, Cherry.
Yeah.
And
Fingers crossed.
I will smash a pumpkin on your behalf if they win. Go Phils. Story number two. And this is an interesting one from the Inquirer about Temple's decision to end a program that allowed Chinese students to pursue advanced degrees at the North Philadelphia school. This is not a large program, only about 30 students. But what's interesting here is why Temple is phasing it out. In July, the school received a letter from a House of Representatives special committee claiming that this program was really a Trojan horse of sorts for the Chinese Communist Party, a way to steal technologies, feed Chinese military and tech ambitions, etc. Of course, there's a lot of tension right now around Chinese students at American universities. Trump has made some conflicting remarks on this topic, but there's certainly some in the highest reaches of government who want to limit or altogether eliminate Chinese students studying at American universities. Again, this is just one small program at Temple, but it speaks to this larger ongoing debate about how open American universities should be to foreign students, specifically Chinese students.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, and the thing is, a lot of universities count on these international students. I mean, I think, you know, President Trump said 600,000 students came from China to America at a certain point, or is, we have a large number, hundreds of thousands of foreign students in American universities, and they many of them pay full tuition. And so, you know, most American students get some kind of financial aid package. And so you kind of need these students. But you're right. It is a sign of the times. And I hope I didn't fudge those numbers there. Probably a little bit.
I believe it's about 275,000 students from China.
From China.
Know what the total number is from all countries. Yeah. I think India has the largest cohort, and China is number two in terms of
students. That's a lot of students.
Obviously, those are both very large countries, so that skews it. But I know, look, for a long time, I think many people viewed this mostly in positive terms, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that countries all over the world sent their best and brightest to America, specifically for like postgraduate degrees, was thought of as a commentary on the strength of the American higher education system, the very system we'll be talking about today.
And you were hoping would keep some of those students here.
Totally.
And they would keep that knowledge at American corporations or even start businesses.
And we're seeing that mentality start to shift where it's seen as a perceived weakness as opposed to, you know, a perceived strength. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all develops over the next few years.
Yeah, we'll be watching. And third story. So a mall in South Jersey tried to charge customers to park in, quote, premium spaces near the mall door. But patrons, they got big mad. So the mall ended that money-making effort. Deptford Mall is the mall. They quietly rolled out the premier parking program where customers could use a QR code to go to a website. They entered their license plate number, and they could pay $10 for one of the spaces near the entrance. And patrons, they all found out during the back-to-school rush, and word spread fast. Folks were seething.
Seething. How dare they?
They called it a mall money grab. And customers took to social media. They started complaining. And they started parking far away from the door and threatening to shop online.
Wait, sorry. I got a mall money grab?
Yeah.
Do they know what a mall is?
I know, but this is
the whole thing's a money grab.
And they were really mad about this $10.
The mall trying to grab your money? What?
But what was so funny is that the mall caved pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And you know, these were only 50 spaces out of thousands of spaces around the mall, but this really ticked people off.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
Fox 29 did a story about it, and the comments were, there were hundreds and hundreds of comments. I mean, people were like, this would make sense for King of Prussia or Cherry Hill, but Deptford Mall?
Oh,
they obviously think very highly of themselves to be charging people $10
I don't know the
space.
Difference between these malls, so I don't know what that means.
But people were upset. And I mean, like, you know, we talked about malls and how they're fighting for survival, right? And you can't charge people $10 for spaces.
They're
not having it.
This is a classic case of you got to know how to pick your battles. And you do not get between Americans and mall parking. I know that. The whole premise of American society is that you should never be required to use your legs to complete a task. And if you are asked to use your legs to complete a task, it should be as little as possible. So making me walk further to get to the mall, that's a non-starter. And I could have told them that. They needed to have me in the idea meeting for this one.
And the veterans parking, the handicap parking, the expectant mom parking, all still free.
Yeah.
But in order to be close to the door, you had to pay $10.
It was a surcharge for convenience, but you can't do that with mall parking. People are nuts about mall parking.
Yeah, don't play with the mall parking.
Do not play with the mall parking.
They
will protest. Well, AI. Park yourself here at Studio 2 for a great conversation about a totally unrelated topic coming up after this break. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're diving into one of the most talked about shifts in higher education, the rise of artificial intelligence in the classroom. From chatbots helping students with writing assignments to professors using AI to make lesson plans, the technology is here and it is evolving fast.
But with that evolution comes real questions. Are students using AI tools to learn or to cut corners? How are professors adapting? And what does all of this mean for academic integrity, creativity, and the future of teaching? Our guest, Clay Shirky, spends a lot of his time pondering these very issues. He's the Vice Provost for AI and Technology in Education at New York University. Clay, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you, Abby. Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, and for all of you listening at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our question of the day is this: how do you think AI is changing higher education, and what pros or cons do you see? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, please share this video with a friend and then leave your comments in the chat.
Clay, one of the things that makes you such an interesting thinker on this topic is the fact that you think about it a lot. Mm-hmm. But the other is that you're totally not a Luddite by nature. Like, you're an early adopter of the internet, and you were kind of in on this idea of integrating AI into the classroom more until, it seems, pretty recently. So what changed over the last year or so in your thinking that made you think, hey, maybe we got this thing wrong?
Yeah, well, I think, Avi, that's exactly the arc I've been through, and I've been through it with my colleagues. I wish I could say I thought about it really hard and I changed my mind because I had sort of internalized everything I needed to know. But really, another faculty member just came to me and said, look, we've tried the thing you've been recommending, right? We have tried to talk with our students about the risk of learning loss, about why not to use these tools if you want to get the most out of this class. It resonates with some students, but it does not resonate with enough students to make the classroom manageable. And I was on a kind of listening tour at NYU last fall, and I...
Well, we just lost Clay there. So we're going to read a few comments,
yeah,
bring in some callers, and we'll try to get Clay's connection mm-hmm. back. Of course, a technology show, right? That's when we lose
the
connection.
I think he might be back.
If we could bring in Deborah from Cape May on line one, Al, yeah, if we could. And Deborah, you are going to give us your thoughts as we reconnect with Clay Shirky.
Okie doke. So my partner, he's a professor at university, and he teaches online, and part of the curriculum on Canvas is that every week the students have to do a discussion question. And he was finding that people they don't even know how to think for themselves anymore. They were going to AI. So what he did was he made a video as part of the opening of the class and had the students take a pledge that they would not use AI. And it's working, but prior to that, almost every kid was referring to AI when it was a discussion question. It wasn't a quiz, wasn't a test. Mm. It was, what do you think about this?
Deborah, can I ask you real quick, how does he know they're not using AI?
Well, he has to check, but they've taken a pledge. They have to put part of the email in their discussion question to say that they agree not to use it. Now, he has to, you know, sometimes he can tell, actually, if ideas are their own. Mm-hmm. It's philosophy. So, you know, it's very specific about what they're thinking or not thinking. So, but it's been an interesting process over the years.
Yeah. Lots of iteration and evolution going on in this space. Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, 2 years ago, it wasn't happening. They were using Chegg and, you know, other ways to copy and paste, but and not attribute. But now, you know, AI is changed everything.
Yeah.
That's
Thank
Deborah
you.
From Cape May.
Thank
Thanks
you,
so
Deborah.
Much, Deborah, for kicking off this conversation. Clay Shirky is back. And so, Clay, we were talking about your evolution. So just to recap for folks, you had endorsed this idea of let's talk with the students about how to use AI responsibly. Let's integrate it into the classroom. Let's not like shun it. And I'm not saying you're a shunner now, but you have really evolved on this issue. So, again, walk us through why you changed your mind.
So we had recommended to all of our faculty, speak directly with your students about learning loss, talk about the ways that the tools can offload the important part of the experience on an assignment, right? If you produce written work without
looks like we lost
any of the thinking, you haven't gotten out of the assignment what the professor meant you to get. We tried that. We had a bunch of different faculty who in one way or another were going after that strategy.
Yeah.
And they said it didn't work well enough to support a whole classroom. There were always enough students who, even when asked not to do it, I wish I was as optimistic as Debbie, who was just on the line.
Yeah.
Even students asked pretty directly not to use it would still use it and basically not acknowledge it.
And
the difficulty, sorry, Cherry, go ahead.
No, and I want to get specific because when the students don't, they acknowledge that they're saying they're not using it, but they're still using it. I want to talk about the problems that it caused because a lot of people may not be in classrooms right now. They may not really understand some of the problems that arise, the challenges that arise, but also the opportunities.
Yeah. Well, the thing you said about your time at Temple, about seeing the writing quality increase, but students not actually having internalized what they needed to do in order to produce that writing, that's the set of trade-offs. If students were to, say, generate an essay and generate it three different ways, compare the versions, understand why one was better than another, that's the kind of use of AI where you get something out of it as a learning exercise. But if you just use it to replace the old work of writing the essay, then it's nearly pure learning loss. One of the things to understand about classrooms is we're not factories, right? The output of a history class is not supposed to be history papers. It's supposed to be historians. And if the students don't have the experience anymore of doing the work, the class is underperforming.
I want to get into how you ensure they do the work, so how you shift some of your teaching methods, your assignment methods. But before we get there, I want to read this comment from Craig. Craig says, I encourage my students at Drexel and Montgomery County Community College to use ChatGPT when they write their essays. I don't allow them to simply drop AI-generated text into an essay without rewriting it in their own words. I also use it when I'm reviewing students' essays. The Economist predicts that AI will decimate entry-level white-collar jobs, similar to what happened in the 80s and 90s to blue-collar jobs, as a result of automation and globalization. I want my students to be skilled in using AI so when they graduate, they will have an advantage when they compete for the few entry-level white-collar jobs that remain. So there is this thought among a lot of professors and folks in higher ed, that it is critical that students learn how to produce work with the help of AI so that they're as fast as the person that they're going to be competing for a job with at producing work in the future. What do you make of that argument, Clay?
I mean, we have to do both. I mean, this is our dilemma in a way. You alluded to, are you pro or con? And neither of those positions is really stable. If it is use AI as much as you want for anything you want, then you are simply checkboxing the assignments without doing the mental effort that you're meant to learn from. On the other hand, if you walk into the world of work and you were looking at job postings that say, we would like for the job candidate to be familiar with AI and you haven't touched it, you're also at a disadvantage. And it's funny, when you go to employers and you ask them in the short term what they want, they'll tick off a list of skills. But if you ask them what they want their employees to be able to do sort of in a large scale, they always say good communicators, problem solvers, collaborators. It's the kinds of things that AI doesn't replace. And so this isn't a substitution. This is a realignment. We are rethinking how higher education relates both to the students inside the university and outside. We have to teach them how to use the tools, but we can't afford for them to just use the tools as a shortcut to not learning from the experience. And that's what makes it the hard problem, is there isn't a stable AI is good or AI is bad. AI is a realignment, and we have to figure out how to manage that.
Yeah. By the way, I want to invite you, our listeners, to chime in. The question is, how do you think AI is changing higher education? What pros or cons do you see? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat. And so, Clay, I want to ask you to sort of give us the range, because the way young people learned in class just 3 or 4 years ago is totally different now. And so if we're trying to figure out where that line is, I want you to walk us back like to 2000, you know, before the pandemic, because 2021 was kind of crazy. But how, you know, you as a professor would teach and how young people would ingest that information versus once you bring in AI, professors are sort of scrambling now to try to figure out, like, how do I make sure that they still understand and learn the information when they're outsourcing a lot? So tell us, like, I'm trying to get at what the change is and how professors have to evolve.
So the big change is that the student output is no longer a guarantee of the student experience, right? In 2019, if you'd asked me to give you some written work and I'd given it to you and, you know, you'd run it through a plagiarism checker, I hadn't copied it from someplace else, you could be sure that I had done that writing. Right. In a way, the assignment was a kind of it was a kind of token of the experience I'd had. I'd had to organize my thoughts. I'd had to think about how to express them. I'd had to, you know, put it into some kind of readable form. Starting at the end of 2022, the existence of a well-written paragraph is no longer proof of human effort or thought.
So true.
Yeah.
And once you realize that's the change, you have to shift your assessment strategies, Cherry, not just your assignment strategies. In fact, one of the things I've been saying to faculty here and when I speak in public to faculty there is we can't get out of this by just redesigning our assignments. We also have to redesign our assessments. Mm. And that means, you know, learning is a change in long-term memory. That's what we do in the classroom. We change people's memories in the direction of whatever we're trying to get them to learn or internalize. And that means checking more directly with them, right? I'm going to have a conversation with you. There's going to be an in-class discussion. You're going to give a presentation. You're going to come to office hours. I have a blue book exam. All of these things point towards a more direct assessment of what the student has gotten out of the assignment and not treating the assignment itself as proof of the experience. Yeah.
I need to know what's in your brain. Like, what have you internalized over this last semester? And I need to find a way to do that without the interference of ChatGPT or generative
AI.
And
the papers don't work. The paper doesn't work anymore.
But let me ask you then, Clay.
That's it, Jerry.
You've alluded to some of the strategies, but I want to kind of get them out there now. Because Karen from Newark, Delaware says, how do we ensure that students who do not use AI are not measured against students who do? So let's talk about assessment and instruction strategies that you feel are close to AI proof, and also how much we should use them. It's funny. I think you describe a lot of these as almost medieval strategies. So we're going back in time here. So what are some of the strategies that you like that you would encourage faculty to use?
Yeah. Well, so one of the reasons I use this sort of medieval comparison, I did this in an op-ed I recently wrote, is to point out that the idea of original student writing is not actually an ancient tradition in higher ed. Reading has always been a big deal, but writing much less so. Writing is a relatively recent expectation, especially of undergraduate students. writing was often to copy down notes, but not to produce your own original work. So returning to that means understanding that if you're going to try to get back at what's in the student's head, like, I want to understand what you've learned, and I can't treat the paper as a proxy for that anymore, then assignments can actually be relatively agnostic about whether the student uses AI or not. If the assessment is, at the end of this process, I'm going to talk to you. So if it's helpful for you to do the research, I'm going to say, give me a comparison of Central American countries' economies in the 21st century. You can absolutely go to Perplexity or Gemini or one of the search tools and say, you know, give me all this data, and you can give me a paper with all this data. It doesn't guarantee that you've learned it. A student who does that manually is much likelier to have learned something about those economies. In the end, if I say, I'm going to talk to you and figure out from you, or I'm going to give a blue book assignment to you and figure out from you what you now know about Central America, it kind of doesn't matter if the student uses AI or not. Mm-hmm. And that opens the door to a bunch of the strategies, like Avi, you said, where it's not punishing the students who didn't use AI, because the test isn't how much material could you produce how quickly. That's factory thinking. It's, did you have the experience of thinking about Central America in the 21st century and the way that this class is about? And if we shift our assessment strategies, there's less pressure on our assignment strategies. I will refer back, I think, to the original caller who said, you know, my partner knows when people are using AI. I hear that a lot, and it confuses two different ideas. Mm-hmm. One is, if I think a student is using AI, they are. I the things I identify as AI, I'm correct about. The second problem is, it absolutely is not the case that if I don't think a student is using AI, they're not. Mm-hmm. And in fact, studies of the AI detection tools say that any attempt to detect the tools are relatively easily defeated by even minor editing. So you can be 100% accurate in your own guesses about which student assignments do use AI, but miss the more sophisticated students who are using AI, but then editing it lightly or adding synonyms or misspellings or what have you.
Can I ask you real quick, though, Clay, just as a follow-up? A lot of the strategies I have seen rely on oral examination and conversation. And I think the fear would be, if we over-index on that, then we will not teach students how to write. We will not get to evaluate their actual writing, because they're not just learning material in college. They're also learning how to express themselves with the written word. How do you solve for that?
Well, so the huge question here is, how valuable is writing in a world where it can be produced by the yard?
Yeah,
that is exactly where I was going next. Do they even need to know how to write?
So the academic essay is a very odd form. It is famously unlike a memo to your boss. It is unlike a pitch deck in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It is its own particular thing. We have been satisfied for decades that the academic essay exercises the kind of thinking we want the students to do in class. But it's not like somebody who's hiring for a consumer package in a consumer package goods company and looking at college graduates ask themselves, can this person write a 1,200-word essay on the Crimean War? Like, it's just not those things don't line up.
Just produce the writing. I don't care how you produce it.
If we can produce good memos, PowerPoints, pitch decks, analyses, whatever the kind of writing that people need, with an aid, essentially with GPS for writing, as it were, it is an open question how much the practical skill of writing, separate from the skill of learning, is actually still going to be in play in 10 years.
Yeah,
I don't have a great prediction of that, except to say that's under more pressure now than it's been at any time in my lifetime.
Yeah, I'm going to read this comment. Citizen Dave on YouTube says it has to be integrated, talking about AI, because it's the future. Law schools are even including it in their curriculum. Get on board, Dave says, or get left behind. I want to bring in a caller. We have Donna from Philadelphia on the line. Donna, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a comment, I guess, generally about AI. I teach in higher ed, and I've also presented on this subject a bit at pedagogical conferences, and I think my main thing is, you know, but my favorite slide to show when I'm presenting is the ostrich with the head in the sand. This is something that's not going away. So mm-hmm. we can't just be like, hey, you can't use it. We need to teach our students how to use it as a tool and not a crutch. There's a lot of negative aspects to the use of AI, but there's also a lot of positive potentials. You know, we've all had our students research things and joke about the first five things that show up on Google. This does actually allow for deeper research if students learn how to use it correctly or are taught how to use it correctly. It's also can make an amazing difference for students with learning differences like dyslexia and ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great comment.
Thank you so much, Donna from Philadelphia. I have a couple questions because I was just thinking about like how in classrooms, you talked about assessment. When I was in law school, one of the things we did was Socratic method. You get called on, you had to prove that you did the reading, and they only gave you two exams. You got a midterm and a final. There were no papers, and that was what you were assessed on, and that was it. And I'm wondering if those types of methods sort of work because you're forced to have those type of critical thinking. And that's a very old school way of doing things. But I wonder your thoughts on that, Clay, and whether there are other old school methods that get rid of the papers. I mean, I hated writing those 30 page papers, you know. And so you wonder, I hated it. I never want to write another one. And so I asked you, Clay, like, what are some of those old school methods you kind of started to list them off that could be brought back in since writing is no longer a necessity that could really test a student's knowledge, their critical thinking skills and their understanding of the information?
Yeah. Well, I think, Cherry, exactly this, that if you are asking a student, what do you know as a result of doing this reading or doing this assignment? That's the kind of core principle here, which is you want to know what's in the students' heads, as Ivy said.
Yeah.
The Socratic dialogue is a famous method. There's cold calling in general. You can have student dialogues. You can have students debate one another in class. I think one of the big surprises is that once people start talking, it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's a new set of skills because it is more extemporaneous. It's more about looking at the student, dealing with the student as they are thinking out loud. So you're not expecting the most polished answer. You're not expecting the most caveated answer, but you're expecting the student to be able to work with the base of knowledge. I think like in your law school example, you're expecting the student to be able to work with a base of knowledge that they understand.
And then my quick follow-up is this, because a lot of students are coming, having not done that type of live work, how do you ramp them up? Because the A student from before who was rarely good at writing could flunk out if that is the new way of assessing a student.
Right. And we are absolutely in that transition now. I've been saying to my colleagues that with the group of first year students that just came in, the youngest undergraduates, the majority of undergrads at NYU now got these tools in high school. So if they are now used to having large language models at their fingertips, but they may well not be used to the Socratic method, to Blue Book exams and so on. And that is really a tough transition because it is a cultural one. It isn't just as simple as I'm putting something in the syllabus statement that says, I'm going to call on you in class and I expect you to know what you're talking about. So it's good if the faculty does that early in the semester. The idea of one exam and midterm and one final is terrible because it postpones the student's experience of adapting to the new normal.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk a lot more about that the other side of this break. Hey, if you're a student out there listening, would love to hear from you about how you're using AI, how you're seeing it in the classroom. We've got already a couple professors who've called in. That's been great. Keep those calls coming, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org, and we will be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We have been talking about how AI is changing education and how colleges and universities are tackling it in the classroom. Some professors are bringing back blue book exams. Others are using oral exams to ensure students are doing the work themselves and not outsourcing it to chatbots. Our question of the day for you, our listeners, is this: how do you think AI is changing higher education? What pros or cons do you see? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat.
Let me reintroduce our guest this hour. Clay Shirky is the Vice Provost for AI and Technology in Education at New York University. Of course, we've been taking your calls and comments. Keep them coming. Let me read this comment from Dan in South Philly. It's long, but it's interesting. I think a lot of entry-level jobs are kind of crappy. You go to college to learn. Everyone tells you you're so smart. Then you get into the professional world. And nobody will even let you send an email without multiple levels of review. Solving problems with ChatGPT is a great way to get ahead. Also, generative AI tools are amazing tutors. You can do a ton of research with them. Colleges should take this into account. They should assume students can learn much faster and adjust accordingly. This brings me back to something we were talking about earlier, Clay, which is the value of writing. And you said it's an open question now about the value of writing. This is where I start to feel old, because it's very hard for me to imagine my own intellectual development separate from learning how to express my ideas through writing. I just cannot imagine it. So I guess I almost want someone to make the case that you can develop as a thinker without really learning how to write all that well and more or less exporting that skill to a machine.
Right. So I'm not saying that exporting that skill to a machine is the sort of thing in operation. What I'm saying is, anytime we get a machine that produces a superabundance of anything, that thing falls in value.
Yep.
Right? I mean, this goes back to the wide frame loom, right? The price of cloth falls once you can make huge amounts of cloth quickly. So if writing is now, you know, if writing can be purchased by the yard, which it absolutely can, then the average piece of writing is just going to become less valuable. That's just the sort of technology. That's what technology does when it creates abundance.
Yeah.
To your point about learning, again, the written essay as a sort of norm in higher ed is something that develops really only after that in the U.S., only after the Civil War, and becomes widespread only after the Second World War.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Cambridge, the university in the UK, they didn't really shift to written exams until literally half a millennium after they were founded. So there's a long, long history of higher ed that is mainly an interactive and oral culture, and writing is a relatively late graft onto that.
Yeah.
So there are ways to become an intelligent, educated person without going through what we all went through of writing the 30-page paper. And then, you know, a cultural problem we have, and it's, I think, maybe similar, Avi, to what you were going through, which is college is run by people who did well in college, right? All of us have been put in charge, like, I like writing papers,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
And so it is, yeah. So Jerry, it's important for us to remember that reaction, right? That facing a 30-page paper is not a joyous challenge. It's like, oh, why I gotta, right? And so the willingness of students to offload some of the thinking is in part because people just do not like writing starting from a blank page. And I think we have to be sympathetic to the students. There are, you know, a lot of people who want to treat this as a kind of kids today, am I right?
Yeah.
Academic integrity problem. But I think we need to have some sympathy for the people who are being asked to do a job that they've often not been prepared for in high school and are suddenly facing these new requirements. I will also say, though, to the comment you just read, you can learn with AI and you can also not learn with AI, which is to say the tool simultaneously enables both more depth or more speed. And those choices are faced by every student at every interaction with the tool.
Yeah.
So it is possible to say AI is a real threat to student learning if they use it to replace their own thinking. And also, AI can be a real boost to student awareness if they use it to improve their research. but both are true.
Yeah.
They're made true by the same tool at the same time. And faculty can forbid but not prevent certain kinds of uses.
Yeah.
So that's the adaptive dilemma we're in.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller because I think this caller will talk about what I want to go back to, is which is how to prepare students for this transition of new assessments. And we have Kate from Philadelphia on the line. Kate, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I am. Hi. Hi, Terry. Such a pleasure. Sorry, I had to pull over to speak. Actually, the previous speaker actually made a really good point that it can be, and that's what I was trying to say, that, you know, it can be an amazing tool to, like, for research. But I think one of the, like, tremendous detriments, like, to learning is that as we learn, we develop confidence to basically switch from the school world to the real world. And that is the most difficult part, you know, because we need to feel confident and we need to feel like we can take the world on. But if all we are used to is getting kind of ready-made answers and we don't know why the answer is what it is, but we use it anyway, it actually takes away our ability for critical thinking. It takes away our ability to defend our thoughts. We become kind of, we believe that we're right because that's the, you know, that's the answer we get, but we can't prove why we're right.
Mm, yeah.
And especially in the, like, in the current, I guess, because of the administration, because of everything that's been going on for, like, you know, a couple of years now, like, students are more and more insecure. There is, like, more and more neurosis that, you know, people have anxieties. And a large part of it, like, however we learn, it's also how we develop as humans and how we develop as adults.
Yeah, thank you. That's Kate.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks. That's Kate from Philadelphia. And I think Kate makes some really good points there. You know, you can use this technology. It gives you an answer. The answer may be right. But if you don't know how they got that answer, do you really know the information? Right. And so how do you sort of transition students? Because we're at a place where we realize that ChatGPT can be crippling our students' critical thinking skills. We've gotten reports that students do not read entire books anymore, and they're outsourcing their writing, which, as Avi pointed out, is a critical step in critical thinking. So how do you transition them to a place where they can confidently speak? Because a lot of students, they don't want to raise their hand. They're not facile with the information. So how do you sort of, as a professor, if you're talking to a teacher, if you're talking to a young person, how do you transition them from this reliance on technology to a person who can critically think and express themselves and really can show that they understand and the information?
Well, so a lot of it is speaking to them, Cherry, the way you just framed the question, right? Which is, instead of saying, I'm just going to expect them to pick up from the assignment that this is what I want them to do, to say to students, look, these tools have real downsides. And even as you're going to be using them, you should know what the risks are. To me, the most important thing that Kate just said in that phone call was the risk that we think our ideas are good because we like to think highly of ourselves. Mm. And these tools have the terrible effect of flattering us. And this was really one of the fateful decisions when they were designing the early versions of these tools. They did something called reinforcement learning with human feedback. Basically, here's a bunch of different answers. Which one do you like best? And the tool kind of optimizes for one answer or the other. But of course, the kinds of answers we like are the answers that tell us we're brilliant. Oh, that's such a good idea. It's such an incisive comment. So few people would say that. And anytime you interact with these tools, it's like you're being buttered up every time you type in a question. Oh, that's such a smart way to approach this. And that is baked into the tools. One of the reasons people like these tools is that they flatter us when we interact with them. And in a way, I'm more worried about the tendency of the tools to be persuasive because they're flattering than I am about the factual accuracy of the output. Mm. Everybody understands that these tools can make facts up, the hallucination problem, the fake citations problem. People are alert to that. The problem isn't solved, but it's a little better. But the much bigger risk, I think, to students is if you're just habitually being told that you're brilliant by a machine that you trust, interaction with other human beings is going to be hugely disappointing, because no human being is going to flatter you. No, seriously. It's, I mean, they, you know, the, all of these reports about the AI boyfriends and the AI girlfriends, like, these tools don't have any internal complexity that you need to be attended to. They're completely attended to you, you know.
And how do you even get better, Clay? And how do you get even get better without critique? And you're in a, you know, right. I mean, because you kind of need critique in order to refine yourself as a student and to get better, right?
Yep. You absolutely need critique. You also need critique just to understand that you can do things that aren't perfect, and it's okay. You know, just the experience of going out, trying something and not doing a very good job, and then having to decide, am I going to try this again? I'm going to try this differently. I'm going to take this as a sign that this isn't what I should be working on. All of those life experiences, which seem like setbacks, you know, right at the time, are the thing that make us resilient enough to be able to then go and interact with the world. So I, you know, whatever, I teach at the university, I should be worried about facts, but I'm much more worried about human development in the face of a conversational partner that will always tell me I'm smart than I am about whether it's giving the right facts about Guatemala.
Yeah. It's like almost like talking to your mom. You know, you're special. You're brilliant. Yeah. so let's talk to Ebon now from the Pine Barrens, who is on the line. Ebon, curious your thoughts here on Studio 2. We're coming toward the end of the hour, so try to keep it brief if you can.
Oh, okay. People in the Pine Lands like to talk long sentences that I will give you my best.
Jump
here.
In, yeah.
One of the elephants in the room here is the question of who controls the AI. Look at Grok. Look at the algorithms that are not just what Clay Shirky is talking about, which is brilliant, which is that it flatters the listener. But who's also putting their fingers on the scales of knowledge? And if we don't teach writing, another part of this component is that, you know, you're sending people out in the world not to generate really good material in the first place, which the AI harvests to produce its own answers.
So you're starving it of its core, of its sort of material core, the thing that it uses. Yeah.
Yes, and it's watering down all of that, and it's similar to the massive history of the Western and the whole planet, for that matter, organized religion controlling the text versus Gutenberg's Bible, you know, producing texts that other people can weigh in on and be part of the situation. It all comes down to sovereignty. Who is what are the beings, the biological beings that matter here? Is it the corporations, which is a pseudo-being, or is it individuals having original, loving relationship with nature, which we in the Pine Lands know a lot about?
Thank you so much.
Kept it pretty brief. You know, did an okay job there, but it was all very interesting. I still think this goes back to the core question, Clay, of what is learning? You described learning earlier as sort of a change in long-term memory. And I think that's a really elegant definition, but I wonder if it does leave out, it's a change in long-term memory, but also a core component of learning is how do you express that memory to the world? And can you use multiple modes, oral, written, whatever else is out there? And I think we're moving maybe toward a world where we don't really think that's a core part of learning. Do you think that's true? That basically learning is really just a test of what you know and not a test of how you express what you know?
So I don't think that we're going to give up on the question of expression, but I do think we're going to move towards a multimodal, multimodal world. I mean, one interesting possibility that AI holds out is that working with images and video and data, which have typically been in the university setting treated as kind of specialist operations, whereas writing is the coin of the realm across a wider number of classes. I mean, even chemists are writing up lab notes. Given that the tools make it easier to produce images, to produce video, to produce graphs and charts and interactive data tools, Are we going to see an increase in the expressive range of the average student, but now operated at a slight distance? In the same way that Photoshop suddenly made photos not just artifacts but editable, as that expands, do we see more students having more ways to express themselves? And we still have to worry. You know, we don't want them offloading the thinking. But it is now possible to imagine a world in which communicating in images, communicating in video, analyzing data becomes less of a specialist purview. And the students get a greater range of expressive capability. And again, this is I keep going back, you know, as I talk to faculty here, there are some changes in the assignments and there are some changes in the assessments. But if we get the assessments right, if we say, I have a way to figure out what's in your brain, I can actually let you use a wider variety of tools in a wider variety of ways because I trust that I can check afterwards whether you
what you actually know. Yeah. That's a fascinating place to end the conversation. Clay Shirky, Vice Provost for AI and Technology and Education at New York University. So grateful to have your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you all so much. I appreciate the invite.
Yes, and thank you to all the callers and folks who emailed in today. Great callers, too. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.